The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. Michael Listener is with us on a special topic, and we'll say more about that in just a couple of minutes. But to brief you a little bit on the Space Show, all of our newsletters are posted, and we're current for the coming week. And I would urge you to check it out. Tuesday, Simberg is back with us. Sunday, Dennis Wingo is back with us. And I don't know what Hotel Mars is going to be yet, but I do know that on Friday we're doing a show with the people from it's Barry Matsumori, if I'm getting it right. He's the Chief Operating Officer of Impulse, and they just cut a big deal that they're promoting and talking about, which you may have heard about. And so he's going to be with us on Friday morning. And again, Barry Matsumori of Impulse Space. And today Michael Listener is with us. More about, Michael, in just a minute. Our newsletters for the week are all posted and up to date. You'll find them on the website. The newsletter is ready to go out at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning Pacific Coast time. If you would like to be on that distribution list and you are not on it, email me and I will add you to it for tomorrow morning's release. And everything we do, as you know, is archived, so you can listen live as we're doing now. You can listen to compressed MP3s archived on our show or podcast. And if you want any support or help with any of these formats, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't forget our logoware store, and you access it by clicking on the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and hopefully you'll find some items of interest there. In addition to that Listen Live menu, which is up at the upper left of our homepage that I told you about just a few minutes ago, we are a 501c3 nonprofit listener-supported show, meaning those of you who listen to the show, thank you for your support because you keep the Space Show going and have kept it going for 21 years. So we have just recently passed our 21st birthday. And as a 501c3 nonprofit, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift and maybe a state deduction, but you need to check with your own state about state deductions. And if you have any other questions, check out our nonprofit website, onegiantleapfoundation.org. Or email me at either david@onegiantleapfoundation.org or drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we appreciate your support. It is what keeps us going. Remember, there's a large PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That is the easiest way to support us. And then you can mail a check if you're interested. It goes to our Las Vegas address, which is on our website and PayPal. And make the check, please, payable to One Giant Leap Foundation. PayPal does show my name. It is an error on their part, and they will fix it as soon as our transition to a Nevada 501c3 is complete. And I hope that is complete within the next 30 days. The funds that come in through PayPal go to our Chase bank account for One Giant Leap Foundation. So despite my name being there rather than Space Show or One Giant Leap, that's where the contribution goes, and that's where you get the receipt from. And we thank you again for your gifts. Don't forget we have sponsors, and we have billboard advertisers. Currently our sponsors are Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society. And our latest sponsor is Dr. Chaim Ben-Arroyo with his two lunar books, which are certainly still exciting and totally relevant, though they were written a few years ago. So if you want more information about the sponsors, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Michael Listener, a very noted, well-known, highly regarded, and respected space attorney, is back with us. Those of you who listen to many Space Show programs know Michael through the Space Show. He also is the founder and principal of Space Law and Policy Solutions, which is a think tank and a consultation firm that concentrates on legal and policy matters for outer space security, industry, and development. And he has a fabulous newsletter, the Pressies, that he writes about. And if you go to his website, you can see a sample copy of that. The rest of his bio is on our website. I urge you to read it and become familiar with Michael's background. We're going to start talking to Michael. So, Michael, welcome back to the program. How are you, my friend?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. Enjoying the desert, the occasional thunderstorm. I like thunder and lightning. I guess I'm a weird duck.
Yeah, so do I.
Oh, you do too. I don't want
to
be...
To an extent, to an extent.
I don't want to be out in it, but I do like to go outside and watch it. It's a good display. And
it is, so, to an extent, as long as they don't get really, really nasty.
Exactly. I won't walk the dog in a thunderstorm. I'll draw the line at that. So what's on your mind today? I know you've been sending me some interesting things on your Space Thoughts YouTube channel about a possible upcoming regulatory move on commercial space. So why don't you fill the listeners in?
Yeah, well, about a week ago... A week ago Friday, the vice president got up and gave a speech, and it was basically a collection of different things. But one of the things he talked about was the administration is going to be unveiling a new regulatory framework for commercial space activities. And of course, with the usual platitudes, America is going to be the leader in outer space and such. Now, she didn't go into detail about what this is going to entail, but apparently on September 9th, the National Space Council is going to meet, and they're going to go into more detail about it. Now, that's, you know, all well and good, and it was very vague, but, you know, given what's been happening with some of the decisions that are handed down by the Supreme Court, you know, it really brought into question whether or not the administration could really, you know, put new framework into place, given... you know, given the current state of U.S. domestic space law. And there's one case in particular, and I'm not going to go through this heavily. I'm just going to really, really gloss just lightly over this Supreme Court case to kind of make my point. But it was called West Virginia versus EPA. Now, what happened was back during the Obama administration, the EPA had this idea for reducing carbon emissions called the Clean Power Act, the Clean Power Plan. And basically, this was the EPA's idea of going in and basically going to the state saying, "Look, you've got to cap your carbon emissions, and you know, if you don't, we will. We'll start mandating, you know, certain you know, requirements." And one of the ideas that they had was actually in this Clean Power Plan was actually telling a utility, like, "Okay, if you have an old utility, you know, you can probably." You can probably, if you want to reduce emissions, you can use it less. You might not want to generate them as much, or you might want to switch over to a, you know, and build a new, either switch it over to natural gas or build a new utility. And if you can't do that, you might actually have to purchase it from somebody who can, you know, who uses natural gas to produce less emissions. Or then you can actually, or if all else fails, you can go out and buy the, you know, you can do these things called carbon credits, or this whole cap and trade scheme that's been talked about for, God, at least a decade, probably more than that. So basically, you know, the EPA, and again, this is the EPA all on its own, thinking about how they were going to do this under the you know, authorization of the Obama administration. And they came to the conclusion themselves, saying, "You know what? Congress does not give us the authority to do that." So, just a little background is, you know, Congress, we have three separate branches of government, the executive, Congress, the legislative, and the judicial. Now, the executive covers all the agencies like the FAA, the EPA, all the letter people, pretty much. And their job is to enforce the laws and create regulations. However, you have the legislative branch, which actually tells the judicial, the executive branch, they create the laws. And they tell the executive branch, we've passed these laws, now you signed it, now you have to enforce it. And those are done usually through the letter people, that I call them, and through the creation of regulations. Now, the idea is Congress actually gives these people, the executive branch and these agencies, the specific authority to make regulations within certain parameters. In other words, the idea is there is a certain, you know, there was a certain point we want you to go, but no further. You are authorized to do that. And the executive branch goes to his agency and says, okay, you have this authority, now go make regulations. And those are provided in the Code of Federal Regulations. And that's no different for outer space, or, you know, for commercial space, what have you. The judicial branch calls balls and strikes. They're the umpires. And basically what they say, you know, well, I'm going to put it simply what they said. This comes from a very important case. You know, if you take con law, it's one of the first cases you learn about. It's called Marbury versus Madison. And the holding, and basically what the court decided in Marbury, and this is back in the 1800s, early 1800s, I believe, where basically, you know, they said, the Supreme Court says what the law is, and which is a very powerful thing and can be taken into context. Either they make the law through their own interpretation, or they interpret the law and tell Congress or the executive branch whether or not it is consistent with separation of powers, the Constitution, what have you. So in this case, the EPA said, you know what, we don't think we have the authority, we don't think Congress granted us the authority under the Clean Power, and under the actual specific authority to create this Clean Power Plan. So we're going to drop it. We're going to find another way to do it. However, what happened is a bunch of states got together who wanted this implemented, and they actually brought the EPA to court saying, you do have the authority to do this. And so it started going through the court system, and the EPA actually defended it. And the whole premise was, well, no, the EPA has this authority. About that time, administrations flipped. Now, all the while is the EPA, while litigating this case, was looking at the Clean Air Act, which is actually a law that was passed by Congress. And there's a certain section, and I think it's called 111D, that they were looking at that's very vague and very broad. And they were thinking, you know what, we can't do a Clean Power Plan constitutionally here, but we might be able to use this broad section in the Clean Air Act, which we have authorization for, and slip it in there and get it implemented. Well, about that time, the Trump administration came into office, and it basically put a halt on it and said, look, you need to review this again. And that kind of slowed things down. But the EPA was still, in fact, you know what? We're still going to use this vague section of the Clean Air Act to go in and actually, you know, implement some of these things with a Clean Power Plan to reduce emissions. Well, another set of states came in and sued the EPA in federal court. It got bounced up, and actually the Supreme Court actually dealt with it, and they just ruled on it. I think it was back in July. They gave their opinion, and basically what the court says is, you know what? We're looking at this vague part of the Clean Air Act, and what you want to be, and basically our question is, when Congress wrote this section of the Clean Air Act, did they intend to give the EPA this much authority? In other words, you know, just when they were writing it, did they actually think that the EPA was given the authority to basically do something as broad or expansive as what they're planning with this? Taking these ideas from the Clean Power Plan they wanted and sticking them in there. And basically, the majority, six out of the nine, basically said, no, they don't. You do not have the authority. Congress did not grant you the specific authority to do what you want to do as far as these generation requirements. Now, it's a fairly long opinion, and it's kind of complex, and if you want to read it, you can read it. It's online right now, so you can actually look through it and read through it. And they go through all the history of it. But fundamentally, what that decision said was, regulatory agencies like the EPA do not have, cannot assume broad authority, out of general broad legislative statutes that are promulgated by Congress. In other words, if you're going to do something as broad and expansive like the EPA wanted to do, you have to have specific authorization from Congress in an actual bill. So that knocked them flat, and then people looked at it and say, well, that was a big setback for the EPA. But what they don't really, but a lot of other people, myself included, were looking at it and saying, you know what, this is a huge case, because not only does this affect what the EPA was doing, but it's going to affect any other federal agencies. In other words, if the federal agencies can't show that Congress specifically intended them to make regulations for what they want to do, they can't do it. They've got to go back to Congress and get the authorities to do it. So, I mean, it was a huge, huge case. I mean, there were some legal experts on it who were just absolutely astounded that, I mean, and they basically said, this is going to change the way we do things for decades. Because basically, it puts the power or the onus of this idea of rulemaking or authorization back onto Congress, and doesn't give federal agencies like the EPA, like the FAA, like the FCC as much broad authority as they were seemingly assuming before this case. So, in other words, if a federal agency were to assume something and start making regulations without congressional authority, if somebody has legal standing, they could come in and challenge it, and they will probably fight this case, and it would probably be very effective in actually winning. So how does this apply to what the Vice President was talking about? One of the things that have been driving people nuts, like myself, over the past 7-8 years is the lack of Congress getting in there and actually writing statutes to broaden out and really give some depth to domestic commercial space laws. I think the last major commercial space law we had was in 2015, and that's the one where we also got, you know, space resources and a few other real goodies. And of course, the current moratorium for regulatory authority on commercial space activities. Those were all given in that 2015 bill that was signed in November 2015. But until then, nobody's been doing anything. And I mean, there are bills for commercial space sitting in Congress right now, but they sit and they die at the end of the Congress, just like this one. There's a lot of bills right now in the 117th Congress that are going to die. So if the administration is really looking to overhaul, to create a new regulatory framework for commercial space activities, I don't, you know, and I looked through the laws, I looked through the regulations again. I said, I don't think they're really going to be able to do it, especially if it deals with space debris. And I just, after she said that, I got a gut and said, you know what, they're going to go after space debris. They're going to start making mandates on space debris, and all because of this thing called sustainability. And don't ask me what sustainability is, because I don't know what the hell it is. I mean, it's just a very hard, very, very broad thing that just creates a fog around everything. It kind of envelops just like the blob from the movie there. But bottom line is, they don't, in my opinion, and you got to take this with a grain of salt, but basically is that they do not have, you know, the administration and their federal agencies like the FAA and such will not have the authority to actually implement this stuff until Congress actually gets in and starts creating more specific authorizations. So that's kind of a nutshell what the video I did, which I'll actually post on to the blog after this, and what I sent you. But basically, that's kind of the impetus of what I was looking at after this announcement was made.
So the moratorium expires October 1 of 2023.
So and that's another thing. How will these new quote regulations? How would that moratorium affect them? I think it's tough because we don't know a lot about it. But I just don't think they have the authority right now to do what they want to do. And to be honest with you, I'm a little bit concerned about what they might want to do.
So it expires, and without specific regulations or laws approved by both houses of Congress sent to the president for approval, nothing can be implemented. Is that correct?
Right. Right, and nothing. Let's be clear. Nothing's going to happen this year, as far as in this Congress.
Well, it's an election year
coming up in less than 3 months.
Right,
and afterwards, it's pretty much going to be a lame duck Congress. then you'll have the 118th Congress coming up in January. Now, depending on what that the philosophy is for that Congress, I mean, they may see this moratorium. They may say, well, maybe we need to reenact it. But more importantly, the viability of any regulatory framework that the administration wants to implement or impose on the commercial space industry is going to be highly dependent on the actual laws that are passed by the 118th Congress, if any.
You have a comment or an email from our friend Todd in San Diego, and he says, at least on the space show, we don't hear a lot about the need for regulation other than in the fields of space traffic management, situational awareness. There seems to be some universal support that there needs to be some rules of the road, so to speak. Are you aware of a push for any other type of rules for the road other than in those areas?
Yeah, I really hate the rules of the road thing. That's just such a cliche term. Well, I'll tell you one thing that a lot of people are talking about is we need, you know, Congress needs to authorize the FAA to permit certain commercial space activities. For example, right now, basically the only real authorization the FAA has to authorize space activities is for the space tourism flights and, of course, you know, basically certain satellite launches involving commercial entities. However, things like, Northrop Grumman with its subsidiary Space Logistics has been demonstrating a RPO, rendezvous and proximity operations with a couple of its spacecraft. They literally had to play Twister and the FAA had to do a lot of jury rigging in order to authorize those two missions, because Congress hasn't specifically given the authority to do that. Then there's, of course, the idea of space resources. You know, that we have this space resource law where they have the right. But, you know, looking at my question is, does that space resource law actually give the FAA the authorization to license an activity like that? And there are other space activities, you know, commercial space activities that may come up, but because the FAA, these, quote, non-traditional activities, because the FAA doesn't have the authority from Congress to license them, they can't do anything. Their hands are tied. Another thing is this so-called on-orbit authority. Right now, the FAA has the authority to license a launch and a reentry. Pretty much everything in between is fuzzy, very gray area. The FAA is kind of, we really don't have a lot of, you know, we really kind of have to be hands-off in between, you know, launch and reentry, because we can't specifically license that part of it. However, you know, but their big push is the Congress saying, look, we need this on-orbit authority so we can properly supervise. In other words, in the Outer Space Treaty, there's this phrase, authorization and continuing supervision in Article 6, and the authorization is the licensing part, but the continuing supervision is one of those things that actually happens in between the launch and the reentry, and the FAA doesn't have the authority, and Congress has been reluctant to give them that authority. On the other hand, you have the FCC, which through the Communications Act, which is amended back in the 1940s, I think, had basically taken a vague section and basically said this gives us Article 6 authority to not only license a communication a satellite using the spectrum, but it also gives us on-orbit authority. I mean, and so they make some pretty bold claims out of that, which in my opinion, I think, could actually be pushed back on because of this recent Supreme Court decision.
So are we better off with the Supreme Court ruling for commercial space, or better off trying to make them come up with real commercial space regulation that would be subject to Congress and maybe the input of the industry? How do you see it?
The thing is, Congress has to act. Under the separation of powers doctrine, Congress has to authorize these agencies to create the laws that give the authorization for these agencies to license these activities. In between, industry has input talking with congressional aides, but also talking with the regulators as well. So they have input on both parts. Now, you know, and again, the big question with the administration is, you know, I think, Mike Gold's a great guy. I had a chance to meet him a few years back. when back in 2017, he would always, in 2017, 2018 era, you know, I heard him speak a couple times, and he was always talking about this continuing supervision provision that really, you know, he said it really scares, you know, the industry, because nobody knows how that's going to be applied. I mean, is it going to be, I'm always looking over your shoulder, or I'm going to be checking in every once in a while, or let us know if there are any problems type of thing. So, I mean, given this administration tends to like to be pretty heavy on the regulatory side, you know, that could be a bad thing. But again, it's a matter, depending on the political makeup of Congress in the 118th Congress, what level of authority or continuing supervision would that Congress actually authorize to the FAA?
Sherry in Seattle, Michael, are you seeing any proposals on commercial space regulation coming from the floor of either house in Congress?
Actually, there's actually quite a few bills right now in existence that relate to commercial space, but really don't do it all encompassing. Hey, you know, it isn't a really big patch as much as, you know, some minor things that actually support commercial space. Those are going to die by the end of the year, because they're really just sitting there, and they have, most of them have been sitting there for over a year. I think it's, and again, this Congress is kind of funny, and it's interesting, you know, because the administration is very, you know, talks a lot about commercial space, but a couple weeks ago, the president signed the CHIPS Act.
Right.
And what Congress did is they put this little section into the CHIPS Act, which is basically a NASA authorization, and it was the first one since 2017. So fundamentally, the way it's set up, and I've gone through it pretty extensively. A lot of it's directed at getting back to the moon, but it's all about NASA. It's all about SLS. I think basically it's a very broad authorization. In other words, we got to get this in here to give the administrator some authorization to actually go ahead and do this. So, and like I said, very broad, very SLS and very SLS centric and Gateway centric. One little mention of commercial space in relation to the International Space Station. In other words, these private individuals who go up to the space station to actually perform commercial activities. But that was the only mention of commercial space in the NASA Authorization Act. Now, going back a few years, I think it was a couple years back when the last time I saw a NASA Authorization Act actually proposed as a separate bill, there were two competing bills. One in the House of Representatives, which was held by, I believe, the Republicans at the time, and the Senate. By the House of Representatives, which was held by the Democrats, and the Senate, which was held by the Republicans. The House Authorization Act was all SLS, you know, this basically Moon to Mars program, all SLS, you know, we want two SLS launches a year, we want all this infrastructure. The other side on the House was more commercial space. Let's get commercial space more involved in this, to getting back to the moon and such. Those things both fizzled at the end of that Congress. And now, in this authorization, you know, given the Democrats control both the House and the Senate, it's basically a Democrat bill saying pro SLS, we want two launches a year until we get to the point where we can actually use the moon to go back to Mars, and then building up all this infrastructure and stuff. And it's very, very broad language, a last minute thing. And again, before people start yelling, "Oh, you're being political," I'm not. I'm just telling you, this is how the two parties differ in their approaches to space. So on the one side, you know, you have the administration is very talking about pro commercial space, but really the Congress just came out and basically gave a more civil centric program, where commercial space is basically not even mentioned for getting back to the moon.
Is there a call for the industry or interested parties to submit comments, or do they just create their regulations and go forward with a vote?
Well, when agencies aren't making regulations, there is a comment period, and you know, industry, non-governmental organizations, private individuals like myself are allowed to, you know, submit comments. I mean, I've submitted comments a few times on some proposed regulations, and from there they make, and from those comments, they go through the process and they do rulemaking. However, if, you know, basically if they don't like that, like, well, for example, we see that in the NEPA case with Viasat, who's basically suing the FCC over granting the SpaceX this authority to lower the altitude of the Starlink satellites. Basically, you know, that was that decision. There was a comment period, and they made the decision, but Viasat didn't like it, so they decided to bring it to the Court of Appeals to have it decided, which actually hasn't been hasn't even moved on the docket for several months yet. So, bottom line is, yes, the industry has an input, but the question is to what effect the industry has in actually, you know, changing the opinion. Again, unfortunately, it is very political, and it depends which administration is in power, well, you know, which party is in power at the time.
Listeners, our phone line is open. It's available if you want to call and talk to Michael about this. 1-866-687-7223. Email is available. Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. And as you know, we prefer telephone. So give us a call, 866-687-7223. Do you have any forecast of how this is going to play out, or any idea, or
We can see right now. Let's you know, on September 9th, they're going to probably give you a better idea of what this framework is all about, and we'll see how it's created from there and actually implemented. I mean, on the one hand, the administration could say, okay, they could go to Congress and say, you know what, this is what we'd like to do. Please authorize it. On the other hand, if they try to impose a thing or create this new framework, carte blanche, they could face some resistance, and I think that Supreme Court case gives ample ammunition for somebody in the private industry to actually bring suit against the FCC or the FAA or whoever's licensing it, and actually challenge it in court, challenge the regulation, saying basically Congress did not authorize this. And I mean, bottom line is, I mean, again, looking at the codes in Title 51 that's relevant to private space activities or commercial space activities, the actual laws are very, very thin, and the corresponding regulations that are based on those rules are thin also because of, you know, the limited authorization that Congress has given to the FAA.
You have a caller on hold. Let's see who your caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. How are you today, and who are you?
This is Marshall, usual place. I remember the EPA, quote-unquote, slow-walking their environmental impact statement for Starlink. And is that because of the weakness of the laws and how loosely they're written? Or is it the politicians, you know, say, I want it to go this way or that way, and, you know, tell people to drag their feet?
A little bit of both. A little bit of both. Because if Congress says, thou shalt, have, you know, basically Congress could write a law that took direct towards the HCs that say, look, you have X amount of time to, upon receiving a request to process it, and to process it, or at least, you know, respond to it and such, and then they would be obligated under that congressional authorization or authority to make it go post haste. However, if they have a very open or vague, you know, loose authorizations from Congress, they could basically interpret the way they want in terms like that. So it can, you know, the regulatory environment can be used to political advantage.
It kind of sounds like the bureaucrats come in with the situation of we really don't want to make a decision, and therefore they just stall until somebody of appropriate authority jumps on their case. How accurate is that?
That's probably might be accurate. I mean, bottom line is, I mean, if the laws don't say you shall process it, and I always look for those shalls in legislation because it doesn't give any wiggle room whatsoever. You shall do this immediately or within a certain number of days after receiving it. I mean, they have no choice. They've got to do it, else they are in violation Congress can come back and say, "What are you doing? You have this mandate here. You should be doing it." That's possible too. And I think the biggest thing with that Supreme Court case that came down is it basically reinforced the fact that it's Congress that creates the author, you know, the scope of how the federal agencies can regulate a certain area. And the federal agencies can't basically regulate beyond the scope that Congress has given them. I mean, there are legal tests in there. I'm not going to go into that right now because that's just, you know, sometimes that gives me a headache too, and I don't want to give everybody here a headache.
I'm sorry. It sounds like I just gave you half a headache right there.
No. Trust me, I deal with people who give me headaches all the time, and I have my Advil right nearby.
Okay. Until next time.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
Listeners, you can call us. The line is available, 866-687-7223. Are there red flags starting to get raised for the commercial space industry that be on the lookout here, or is it below the horizon so far?
Yes, because, you know, there are two, and I hate to call this a philosophy because, you know, philosophies are things that people think about and, you know, and spend time writing about. But there are two viewpoints on how regulation should occur. Now, on the one side, you have people like me who say, you know what, we really don't know what kind of space activities or how, you know, can really be done in our space or how these are going to actually occur or what's going to pan out. So we can't really, how can you regulate something you don't really understand or you haven't had experience with? So my perception is get authorization that the FAA has under Article 6, go and do a mission, and you might screw up a little bit, you might have some problems, and they might say, okay, based on the experience you've had, we'll make some regulations to kind of just tighten things up a little bit, and then but other than that, we're not going to put a leash on you, we're not going to start putting barricades up and telling you you shall not go there or go there, but we're going to regulate it. We're going to put regulations in as guidance. We're going to, you know, to help guide you. On the other hand, there's a viewpoint that we have to, you know what, even though we haven't started doing a lot of these activities, we got to start putting regulations in place to kind of guide industry. In other words, you're basically going to put industry in what I call a rat maze. You know what, there's cheese there somewhere, but you're constrained by the maze. To figure out, you know, work your way through the maze in order to get to the cheese. So that's, you know, that sounds good. And these are what we call prescriptive regulations. In other words, thou shalt do this or thou shalt not do that. And, you know, you'll get penalized if you do this or do that. And the last administration would really pull back a lot of these prescriptive regulations. However, I think and another thing that gives me a lot of hesitancy about this regulatory framework is it's going to get very prescriptive. They're going to put in this canned idea of how space activity should work, and it's going to be discouraging. I'm an observer with a group of governmental experts, if you want to call that, on basically talking about lunar surface activities, they meet monthly on Zoom, and I get invited. I'm invited to them, and I sit and listen to them. And they're creating this horrendous document on guidelines for future lunar activities. And I'm sitting here thinking, what the hell is going on here? I mean, they're basically deciding the way, you know, what way things should work without actually having gone out and done them. Now, some of the actual members of this group are members of industry, and you know, just watching that, you know, watching their reactions, they're like, it's like they're just shaking their head because they don't. They're just incredulous that you know this viewpoint wants to go out and pre-regulate everything, and it's going to create an immense amount of expense for them. And it's actually and it really makes you think: is this based on having to deal with all the regulations they're putting in place? They want to put in place to begin with, versus the expense that it would be to comply with the regulations. Is it really going to be worth it to do it? And I really think that's where. If this thing is done incorrectly, for one thing, if Congress doesn't authorize the scope of this correctly, it could get out of control really, really quick. And rather than be, we just say the U.S. could say, yes, we have a leadership role, in commercial space, but I think they'd be in a position of, you said, see the big stack of regulations we have? And here's the danger. There are a lot of countries right now who are passing, who have passed or are in the process of passing commercial space laws and regulations, and they look very attractive to industry. One of them is New Zealand. New Zealand just reviewed their high altitude, and I think I mentioned this last time I was on June. They just reviewed their space law that they passed a few years back. They did a three-year review, and, you know, they got Rocket Lab involved. They got Leo Labs involved, who are two commercial operators who work out of New Zealand, and they were pretty happy with it. Said, you know what? But based on our experience, we can tweak it here, we can tweak it there. So they're not getting carried away with it. And it's becoming a very great spot for, you know, very attractive spot for especially small sat launchers. Saudi Arabia just passed the Artemis Accords, I think about a month or so ago, which surprised me for one thing, but really astounded me because they are the largest oil producing country in the Middle East. And I can tell you right now, between them and the United Arab Emirates, they're going to be serious competition for if they really, because I think they understand the importance of space, and they could provide a very nice area or a very nice economic environment and potentially a very nice political environment for commercial space operators. So, especially if they make their regulations light touch, and fundamentally, so the question is, do you want to create such onerous on domestic space operators to the point where they're saying, you know what, is it really worth launching under the U.S. jurisdiction, even though the U.S. has a lot of political power, or do we want to take a chance and go to one of these other countries? They may have a little less political power in the grand scheme of things, but you know what, they have some pretty light-touch regulations. They look like they'll work with us, and we could probably get a lot more done and be a lot more profitable. So that is a danger right now. That I almost call it a danger. That is the conundrum that is facing, you know, this new regulatory framework. I don't think it's going to streamline anything. I mean, I think SB2 is about streamlining the licensing process. And, you know, my thoughts was, if you want to streamline it, burn it down and start from scratch, because the whole payload authorization thing is a mess. And I've actually suggested somebody several years ago, you got to talk about, instead of payload authorization, talk about mission authorization and work from that paradigm. Long discussion. I won't get into it here. But the whole idea is if we make things more onerous for commercial actors here, are they going to really want to launch from here, especially the smaller ones? The primes will always do it because they have, you know, they have the resources to deal with the regulatory environment. But smaller ones that might actually, you know, go to these other stations that have these domestic laws and these light touch regulations and say, you know what, we'll take a chance politically, you know, that they can protect us because right now it looks like it's worth it economically.
You have Barbara in Reno, Nevada, and says, what type of power and influence does Vice President Harris have for space, and what is the makeup of the National Space Council now?
I'm not sure about, you know, there are a few heavy hitters on the National Space Council. One of them, Diane Howard, which I was very glad.
Michael, are you there? I lost you. Yes. Hello, Michael. Michael, where'd you go? He's on the landline too. Hello, Michael. Can you hear me? I'm going to have to call you back. I can't hear you. I don't know what happened. Sorry, listeners. I don't know where Michael went, but maybe his line, the battery died or something. I will call you back, Michael. Stand by. Listeners, I'm going to call him back. Please stand by, and we'll be right back, okay? Good evening, listeners. Welcome to a very special edition of The Space Show on Monday evening. I'm your host, David Livingston, and thank you very much for tuning in. So for those of you who know and were listening to Michael Listener on our Sunday show yesterday, we were most rudely interrupted when Cox Cable had an area outage, and we were included in that area. So the show and the internet and the phones and everything went down. So we made it through 45 minutes with Michael, and then Cox conked out. So we're going to resume that program tonight. And I will then edit the archive of the first 45 minutes and put this program in on it. So the full program will be archived on the Sunday date as if it were a normal Sunday show without the interruption. I'm not going to do a full introduction tonight because you know who Michael is. He's a great space attorney, and we're talking about the possibility of regulations coming up in the near term for the commercial space industry based on an announcement said recently by Vice President Harris, and which will be a topic of the upcoming National Space Council meeting in early September. Our toll-free number, if you would like to call in and talk to Michael, 866-687-7223. You can send email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. I did archive the first 45 minutes, and I do hope you had time to listen to it today so you know what we were talking about and what Michael was talking about, especially right before we went dead. Michael, welcome back, and thank you for coming back on so quickly and finishing up yesterday's program here on a Monday evening. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. I don't like to leave things unfinished.
Nor do I. When we lost Cox Cable support yesterday, Barbara had asked you a question. I believe she was from Denver. And you had mentioned the Vice President's announcement and that we would know more when the National Space Council convened. And Barbara sent in a note asking you what the, I'm paraphrasing, what the makeup of the National Space Council was, what its leanings were, and what did you think the National Space Council may or may not do about regulating commercial space in the near term?
So, the Space Council is basically made up of appointees from, you know, from the executive branch. This administration chose a whole new cadre of individuals to serve on the council. They continued it on from the last administration, which is laudable. There's a lot of people. One person I really want to bring attention to is Diane Howard, who is just a really super lady, very smart, very, very articulate, passionate, especially about commercial space. She formerly worked with Commerce during the last administration. They created a position for her within Commerce in the space area, specifically to act as kind of a liaison between Commerce and other agencies that were involved in commercial space licensing. So she no longer held that position after the other administration left office, but she was appointed to the National Space Council. So she's very enthusiastic about it, and from my perspective, it's a very good thing to have her on the council like that.
Who else is on the council?
You know what? I can't recall right off the top of my head, but it's populated. But and they've also added representatives from some other energies, other departments. I think the Department of Energy actually got a seat on the National Space Council as well, and I think the intelligence community is represented as well on the National Space Council.
So the chairman of the Department of Energy has influence on the National Space Council?
Their representative does. I'd have to look at it. I haven't looked at the makeup of the council in a while now, but that's kind of a brief overview who's on, you know, what the council's makeup's about. There's a list online. You can go online and just
I'm going on it now. But that's makes me nervous with the Department of Energy woman. Anyway, I'll just
not really. I mean, if you're going to use nuclear power, and I mean the last administration was very pro nuclear power in space, and if you're going to use nuclear power, the Department of Energy is responsible for nuclear energy and basically anything nuclear in the United States.
Yeah, but anyway, I'll just leave it. Listeners don't need my comments on that. There's 20 members on the National Space Council. I was actually looking for the list of them. Do you think their leaning is for pro additional regulation, or what do you think their leanings might be?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, you know, the Vice President's remarks were so broad, and you know, we you know, she talked about leadership and you know, being leaders and role models, and I don't, and I think it's, unfortunately, I think, you know, with this administration, there's such a heavy emphasis on environmentalism right now that this concept of what's called sustainability is going to be a big part of these, you know, this new regulatory framework that they want to put out there. And I think that's it's going to cause, I think that's going to be detrimental, and especially when it comes to the idea of space debris. Now, yesterday when I was talking about this, I came back and said, look, these regulatory framework, I mean, they just can't say we're going to do it. I mean, I don't, because like I said, I don't think they have the proper authorization from Congress to do it. However, you know, this push for like sustainability, which, you know, a friend and I were talking about this last Friday during a morning phone call, morning Skype call, and you know, the big question is, what does sustainability mean? And it's such a vacuous term and concept that it really is. It's almost like Jell-O in a sense. You know, it's just like a Jell-O mold. It wiggles a lot. Has no real super firmness to it. But it seems like to be a catch-all phrase to basically, you know, advocate for, you know, different things like space debris mitigation or what have you, in a sense. So, I mean, the U.S. has really been pushing on this idea of sustainability, and, of course, the EU and the UN. Of course, the Russians and the Chinese don't really care about sustainability, which the Russians demonstrated with their ASAD demonstration back in November. But that's going to be one of the big things that I think you're going to see that's going to kind of underlie all these this regulatory framework that they want to implement.
So you can't predict which way it might go then.
Based on what I've seen from the regulatory environment right now, it's probably not going to be a positive. It's probably not going to be a positive direction. I think it's going to be more prescriptive than guideline. You know, just being put out there as guidelines.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the regulations are just popping up, you know, left and right now. And that's just the way the political environment is right now. It's just pro-regulation administration, as opposed to last administration was basically like, you know what, we got to cut through a lot of the red tape and you know, get it out of the way. So that is probably a likely step forward, because I know in a European mindset there's a lot of you know, this pro-regulation idea. Oh, we got to regulate everything first, and then you know you can play within the regulations. That would be my presumption of the direction that it'll be moving. Again, I'll find out more on the 9th, but again, based on the political atmosphere, I'm really not too confident about the direction it may go.
Are there meetings opened? Are they streamed online, or do we just get news reports about them?
Well, the National Space Council is basically a catch-all for everything that goes on. I mean, when the last administration started up the National Space Council, I really didn't like the format, because there was a lot of pomp and circumstance. As far, you know, I was basically there saying, look, you know, there's a lot of, you know, let's get down to business. But the vice president at the time loved to be, you know, sitting among the hardware, whether it be behind a space shuttle or with some of these new generation capsules versus the old era capsules. There was a lot of pomp and circumstance to it. However, as a colleague pointed out, I said, look, this is basically the frosting. The real substance is actually being worked out behind the scenes, and these meetings are basically culminate in, you know, what the results of those meetings are. It's basically a very broad picture of the machinations going on behind the scene.
You had another email question that came in from Fremont John. Harris's announcement that she intends for the NSC to work to revise commercial space regulations to make sure our nation remains a role model for the responsible use of space, because we want to keep pace with the tremendous rate of innovation. Doesn't sound bad to me. You spoke on Sunday about your preference that the government take a light touch to regulations until we get out there and begin to get some experience. Excuse me, everyone. Can you give us a couple of examples of what could be wrong? What are your greatest concerns?
Well, the concept of sustainability that I just talked about. I mean, this whole idea of responsible use of space is a catchphrase for basically, you know, in my opinion, you know, regulating things and basically tying people, you know, tying hands of the you know, these people, of these individuals, these private entities that want to get out there and do things. So, I think overall that is probably the biggest concern, that term responsible space. And of course, you know, innovation gets used, just thrown around so much that I really don't give it too much credence anymore. I'm more, look, you know, don't tell me that you're being innovative. Show me you're being innovative. Responsible use of space. Well, what's the responsible use of space? I mean, that, you know, depending on who you talk to, or what state they're talking with, that could be, you know, that's very subjective. So, but again, my feeling is that this idea of sustainability is going to be pushed out in this regulatory framework. But again, I'm going to go back all the way to the beginning, what I talked about yesterday. I don't think there's the authorization within Congress to actually implement this regulatory framework based on a case that West Virginia versus EPA.
So, as an example, they could issue a regulation that pretty much stopped Musk from taking humans to Mars, and then Musk might protest that and say Congress hasn't authorized that, so your regulation is meaningless. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, that would be more a decision on not to grant him a launch license as opposed to a regulation. However, they could start imposing other regulations on him about, you know, well, you got to meet certain levels of, you know, decontamination for between our planetary protection protocols. Those are actually worked in on the civil side, so you'd have to really try and put that into the commercial side as well. So you might need a little bit more authorization from Congress to do that. They might say, well, when and if you get, you know, if we're going to let you go to Mars, you need to do this, this, and this. You know, you've got to mitigate the space debris from your rockets. Well, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing I've read in the current Title 51 that basically, you know, says that Congress granted the FAA the authority to tell, you know, commercial operators, you've got to mitigate your space debris. Now, I will say that, interestingly, industry has been doing this on their own accord. And a good example is I love watching ULA launches because they're just a lot of fun, and you get a lot of tracking, you get a lot of good discussion. But one of the interesting things is after the satellite separates from the Centaur, after the Centaur is done, you hear the next phase, which is where basically they set the Centaur into the proper orbit where it's going to re-enter or go into, you know, just often do the solar system someplace. But what they do is they defuel it, any remaining fuel, and they discharge the batteries. And this is one of the biggest problems. I mean, when people talk about space debris in particular, they think about, oh, ASATs, and oh, you know, these are big contributors to space debris. The biggest contributor to space debris really is these upper stages that are sitting in orbit that haven't been defueled and didn't have their batteries discharged, and the extremes of the environment eventually cause them to basically explode, and those create big debris generating events. What industry is done saying, you know what, we got to start taking care of things up there and being a little bit more responsible on our own accord. We're taking the initiative to actually defuel these and discharge them. There's no mandate required for them to actually do that because Congress didn't authorize it. However, they are taking the initiative, and this is why I think industry is in a better place to regulate itself instead of, you know, the government trying to regulate it. Now, there is a few companies that say, well, you know, tell us what we can do or what we can't do, basically the hand-holding approach to regulation, as opposed to, well, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like when you're a kid, you know, if your parents are always holding, you know, basically, what do they call them, helicopter parents, are always hovering, and basically the kid, you know, kids don't, you know, learn and take chances and explore. On the other hand, if, you know, the kid is usually the troublemakers. They go out, they try things, they get hurt and get in a little bit of trouble, but they learn things, and they eventually get you know, get more further ahead than others. They have more initiative to become more leaders. I think that's more the approach right now that, you know, industry would like to take, most industry would like to take, as opposed to, you know, basically, you know, the hand-holding and tell us what we can, what we can and can't do. I mean, there was, you know, this old maxim that it's better to seek forgiveness than ask permission sometimes. And I think that's the same thing with space. You just got to take some, once you get your license and your authorization, you just got to push it a little bit. And, you know, if the government says, well, we're not too crazy about that, then I'll say, okay, and then have a chat with them and go from there. I mean, look at rendezvous and proximity operations. There's no, for one thing, there's no authorization for it, but the FAA did a lot of, you know, played a regulatory twister and to approve these two missions, but everything they've been doing up there, there's no regulations. Now, however, from all these activities, there are actually standards that are being created. And standards are important because once you have standards, whether it's technical standards or standards of the way you do things, you create two things. One, you create commonality in terms of equipment so that it's easier to interact with other space objects and other space activities. But you also develop these things we call norms. And I really, really hate how norms are being used today because, you know, the U.S. is basically saying, well, you know, we're going to the U.N. and we're trying to create these norms, these, quote, norms that really aren't norms. And basically they're trying to get together and agree what's responsible behavior and not, and say these are norms when they're not really norms. But I digress. However, you know, in my opinion, what Northrop Grumman and Space Logistics LLC has been doing with their rendezvous proximity operations, they're creating norms right now. I mean, they're actually creating what's considered by performing this, they're creating acceptable behavior. And as other countries pile on, and I can tell you, I can tell you right now that this, and yeah, I can tell you without getting. Yeah, I can tell you this. Basically, these activities are becoming accepted. And the more they become accepted in the international community, that's where you get your norms. That's where you get your customary international law, through activity. Again, this activity was never regulated, was not regulated or permitted, or specifically permitted, authorized by Congress. However, they found a way to grant the authorization, and through that, the activities that they're performing are actually creating norms right now. That's what true norms are about. So, I mean, bottom line is, you know, you can sit down around a table and discuss, you know, with a bunch of academics and engineers and whatnot, and talk about what regulations should be, what limits should be. But until you've really done an activity, you really don't know how to make a regulation. In my opinion, it's like the person who basically, in a sense, the person who designs a product versus the person who actually assembles it. The person who designs it might look and say, you know what, we know from our calculations and all our paperwork here and our simulations that this is the way it should work and this is the way it should be put together. However, the person actually putting it together, actually performing the assembly, who's actually worked with the components, might say, you know what, I have a better way because I've actually put it together and I actually understand it. So that's the difference, you know, between and that's kind of the analogy between, you know, using engineers and the person who actually assembles a product online to compare what I think the difference between pre-regulating and regulating as you go along.
Excuse me, you have another email from Tim, is in Boston, and he says, there was some issue in the Obama administration that space might be considered a global commons by the United States. That was clearly not the case with the Trump administration. Is it possible that regulations could come forth with the U.S. signing on to space being a global commons?
Yeah, you know, this is a good opportunity to nip this in the bud. Certain individual, there was a U.S. Spacecom held their second annual legal conference back in April, and I watched it virtually. I mean, it was just awesome. One of the panelists actually brought this up, saying, basically insinuating that the Trump administration promoted this idea of outer space as a global commons. And However, Outer Space not being a global commons, it kind of insinuated that this was, you know, something the Trump administration brought up. However, that hasn't been the case. For the past 50 years now, U.S. policy has been outer space is not a global commons. And I see a lot of people in government who don't understand that. They think it's part of the global commons, but it's not. Now, why does the U.S. hold that position? I don't know. I mean, and nobody knows. And that's something that the U.S. that the U.S. diplomatic corps keeps close to its, you know, chest. Basically close to its chest. We don't want to reveal our cards of why the U.S. takes that position. However, and I want to emphasize this to listeners. Space has not been a global commons. It never has been a global commons as far as the U.S. is concerned. And it probably, and hopefully we don't change that stance, because it will be a significant blow, I think, to, you know, this whole idea of, you know, non-governmental space in particular, among other things. I have a lot of respect for Dr. Pace. I listened to him back in 2017. He was a keynote speaker at an event I was at and down in D.C. And he basically came right out and in his speech and emphasized this in a paragraph very, very sternly, you know, and very, very succinctly. There were a lot of people there from Europe and overseas and such, and who believes in this global, you know, space is a global commons thing. And after he said that, you know, space wasn't a global commons, there's no, you know, there's no res communis, no whatever, space isn't the province of all mankind, what have you, things got pretty tested. I mean, you could feel the tension in the air, because, you know, he basically just restated U.S. policy. So understand, U.S. policy has been for almost 50 years now, outer space is not a global commons.
Is Scott Pace still involved in any way with the Space Council or with giving input to it?
I'm pretty sure he resigned. I think he's back teaching at Georgetown right now. You see him pop up every once in a while in the media. He gets interviewed in the media every once in a while. But basically he bowed out, I'm sure, after, you know, with the change of administrations.
Is it worrisome? Is the regulation risk at a worrisome level, or just be aware of it?
Just be aware of it. I mean, it's something to watch and see what plays out. But again, I want to emphasize, you know, and this gets back to my original premise that I talked about yesterday with that Supreme Court case.
Uh-huh.
That basically, you know, you can come up with this grand regulatory scheme, but in my opinion, Congress has not actually passed legislation to actually allow, you know, to authorize these agencies to impose any type of, you know, real stringent regulatory setup. And in fact, you know, we talked about the moratorium issue. That was a specific prohibition put into place by Congress through legislation back in 2015. So look at this way with the executive branch. The executive branch is basically there to enforce the laws. It's not there to make the laws. Congress makes the laws, and that includes commercial space laws, and to the extent that, according to the Supreme Court case in West Virginia versus EPA, you know, agencies basically have to follow the mandates of Congress, you know, and basically their direction. They can't, you know, they really can't go off the reservation and do their own thing.
Michael, here's an email from Alex in Chicago, and he says, Michael, many of us have observed over the years that Supreme Court rulings are not always enforced. A good example of that are presidential executive orders that are ruled unconstitutional and nobody enforces them, and the executive order continues to play out. The DOJ won't enforce them. The Supreme Court has no enforcement mechanism. So just because the court ruled this way, that doesn't necessarily mean cases would be decided that way. Can you either correct me or explain what seems like a big flaw in the system?
In particular, this case, you know, in the case of, you know, if a litigant came up and decided to sue one of the federal agencies that is responsible for granting launch licenses, because and basically saying, well, you know, you're imposing this regulation on it, and Congress never gave you the authority to do this. And they could come, and basically if they could sue the agency in federal court, say in the district court, it would be in the district court for the D.C., would probably be one of the originating, or even in under one or two different theories. But bottom line is, they would say, look, you know, this agency does not have power. And, oh, by the way, in this holding of West Virginia v. EPA, the Supreme Court held that federal agencies cannot exercise power that is not expressly granted to them by Congress. So, in other words, you're going to use legal precedents from the Supreme Court, which basically says what the law is, to get a judgment from a lower federal judge, a lower court, to actually, you know, enforce that principle. So in other words, it would basically say you can't impose this regulation on it because it's unconstitutional. The enforcement of it, you know, sometimes a lot of that's political, but really the agencies are pretty good on that. I mean, the FAA has been really, really good about saying, look, we don't have the authorization to do it. They want to do a lot. They want to work a lot, from my understanding, with operators. But like I said, we don't have the authorization from Congress for a lot of these things. And they've been begging Congress to actually, you know, move and give, you know, grant them more authorization through successive legislation.
Well, we've all seen political courts that don't enforce the laws and do what they want to do based on ideology. Maybe they get overturned down the road or not. But,
well, the one thing is, I mean, you know, if one court, you know, if for example, in that example that I gave, they brought to the D.C. District Court, and the judge, you know, basically ruled against the plaintiff, even though they cited that binding precedent in the Supreme Court, that binding precedent, they can appeal that to the Court of Appeals, the D.C. Court of Appeals. Now, one thing a judge does not want to have happen to him or her is to be overturned by an appeals court. It looks really, really bad on their record. I mean, even at the state level here, I've seen appeals where judges have played, or even administrative agencies have played God and decided they're going to do their own thing, and the court, and it was actually challenged in state court, and I mean, where the state Supreme Court came back absolutely brutally on the administrative agency, say, look, you do not have the authority. This is what the law is. You have to follow the law, not what you want to do. So judges basically do not want to get overruled. So they're going to, for the most part, if they can keep the politics out of it, they're going to rule by the law. The whole idea is you got to put your politics away from, you know, and look and basically make your decisions based on the law. Else you may get overturned by a much more senior court, and that doesn't look good on your record.
At what point can interested parties anticipate a comment period to regulations?
Oh, they all have. You know, most of them do have comment periods. Anytime there is a notice of a proposed action or a proposed rule, there's always an opening for a comment period. Although there was one exception, I came across this just the other day. Is the Coast Guard is actually establishing temporary safety zones, three of them, in and around the Florida, in separate sections up and down the Florida coast for SpaceX reentry. And these safety zones are actually going to be in effect from actually starting today until the end of September. Now, this is only a temporary rule. So because it's temporary, there was no comment period allowed because of the fact that the rule is going, you know, the focus of the rule is actually going to expire on the 30th. So for these temporary things, you know, hearings, you know, due process is basically, there really is no need for this due process. However, for larger, you know, for these larger permanent regulations, all the agencies have comment periods where the public can come in. These environmental assessments that get done, you can have, you know, there are comment periods, and this is where the real fun begins. I know people were getting really upset with, you know, SpaceX, you know, not being, you know, environmental assessment for SpaceX back a few months ago being delayed and delayed and delayed by the FAA, and people are getting upset and they're saying, look, you gotta understand, they have probably half a dozen, if not more, NGOs and environmental groups nipping at them. And they're going to look for any weakness. So they've got to make it absolutely bulletproof. Else, they'll give them a really good cause of action in court to challenge it. So that gives you these groups, individuals. Heck, I think I even mentioned this yesterday. Even I commented on some of these proposed rulemakings, and give my own personal input as a subject matter expert. So there is, the idea of due process of having an open comment for the public, it does exist.
Interesting. Listeners, our phone line is open if you would like to call Michael, and there is still plenty of time for that, 1-866-687-7223. Email is still available, and drspace@thespaceshow.com, and Cox Cable is working. So we would like to hear from you in the remaining time. And Tony Cook has a question from you in Pasadena. He says it's a Starlink question. Can you comment on the status of Starlink now? Does the U.S. military override the expected commercial development of this constellation? Is this why SpaceX no longer shows Starlink deployment?
Actually, they do show Starlink.
I get their press notice.
They had two launches.
Yeah, I was going to say, I get their press notices all the time to log on and see them.
I mean, Starlink is purely a civilian, is basically a private, effort that's actually funded by SpaceX. It's funded by SpaceX privately. The military has, as far as I know, has no actual involvement in the deployment of Starlink, but they're taking a close look at it. I think we talked about this when I was back here on June. If you listen to the June show, I talked about that at length. The military, DOD, they might end up actually using it because it's proven very effective in the Ukraine and the situation that's going on over there. But otherwise, the military, it isn't a military project like GPS or anything like that. It's strictly a private endeavor. And actually, the launches are publicized. I mean, I watched two of them last week on YouTube, and I think there was just another launch just the other day or so. There's just so many. I mean, they're really going full bore on getting those satellites up, and they do like 52 at a time.
Well, there's something that regulations could be adverse about in that having to do with spectrum and Starlink launches or something related. That seems to be a raw area where you could get regulation crazy and have some detrimental effect from it. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the spectrum's limited. And I know Dish and Dish Network and SpaceX are basically having sword fights right now, especially when it comes to receiving the frequencies for receiving stations. It's a big kerfuffle, and this is something, Dish has been actually very, kind of an adversary of SpaceX when it comes to Starlink. In fact, this whole kerfuffle with Viasat, Dish Network actually, was part of the appeal, and they're just dealing with the spectrum part, not dealing with the quote the NEPA stuff that Viasat's alleging. But yeah, spectrum is a huge thing, and I think there's more litigation going on, space related litigation going on right now over spectrum than anything else.
Wow. Yeah, interesting. Isn't Dish part of AT&T now?
I don't know, but. They're trying to hold on to certain amounts of spectrum. I mean, they have their spats. I mean, you see these letters going to the commissioner, the FCC commissioner, about they're complaining about each other quite frequently. So their lawyers are pretty busy writing a lot of letters. I mean, people talk about space wars. Well, the real space wars are being fought by the lawyers right now, and a lot of it has to do with spectrum.
You've got a note, excuse me for my voice again, George is in Atlanta, and George says, including regulation and what may or may not happen, if we're interested in following this and we pay attention to the meeting on the 9th, will we have an idea, or is this really something that is a backdoor cigar smoke room deal like you insinuated earlier, and the only way we might know the direction is if there is a period of comments or they publish a regulation?
Well, when the regulations are proposed, whether it's the FAA, the FCC, or NOAA, Commerce, what have you, there's always a comment period, and it's usually about 30 days minimum, anyways, comment period.
Yeah.
You can actually send comments in. Regulation, actually, www.regulations.gov is usually the central database where all the current things are, proposed regulations actually come up. And I guess, and I don't want to clarify, it's not really a backfilled cigar room, machinations as much as, this stuff goes through the multiple agencies that are going to be involved, and they work it out, and basically their staffs work out the details, and basically the National Space Council is kind of like the big hurrah! Hey, this is what we created. They don't create they don't make those decisions or come up with those ideas right at the meetings. There's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes, where it's a lot of sausage making for these ideas that come along. And that was the same thing with the Space Council from the last administration too.
Do you think that regulations might adversely impact or change the space tourism industry? I mean, right now, it's almost pretty hands-free, right? But is that something that is now vulnerable since it's in effect, it's going, and you've got at least one active company? I don't know if you'd count SpaceX as a space tourism company, but they basically engaged in it, and I have no idea what the role will be of Virgin in that. But
I don't know. It's possible they might add something on. But again, we're still in that moratorium period until
October of 2023.
Yes, in October of next year. So,
right.
So fundamentally, and again, that was something Congress specifically mandated. So a regulation cannot override that. The president or the executive branch can't override that. And it gets back to this whole idea of separation of powers and the powers delegated to the separate branches of government. And again, it's basically the idea of keeping, a balance of power and the respect for these three branches of government. And that's what this is about.
I don't know if you want to venture down into the National Security Road or not, but I'll read you Paul's email, then if you don't want to deal with it, you don't have to.
Okay.
Paul's in St. Louis, and he said, last Friday, David had one of his favorite national security people on, Dr. Goswami, and she had an awful lot to say. I think it's a really interesting show to listen to, but she was very concerned about the U.S. and how they appreciate or don't appreciate commercial space in space and how it's not being valued, especially in comparison to, say, China, and that we're not valuing it in the right way for diplomatic purposes and for other purposes. And she questioned the quality of our leadership. I'm wondering if you would opine on anything to do with our leadership. Are we really understanding the importance of commercial space and space, and is it being advocated in the best way possible for democracy in space and for the West to continue to be a leader in the space with the U.S. as the leader of that?
Yeah, for one thing, I don't like the whole democracy in space thing, which is kind of a little bit fluff. But in a short answer for everything, are we valuing commercial space? No, we're not. We don't. We're still have the tug of government civil space. Well, and that we have that big thing called SLS, which is supposed to go on. The launch window opens on the 29th of this month, and a lot is riding on that launch. a lot is riding on that launch. And I said that twice because it's very important. If something goes wrong, there's going to be a lot of people, you know, coming out of the woodwork with baseball bats, ready to knock it out. But the idea, I guess this gets back to, you know, I guess to illustrate this with a certain individual who shall not be named, who called me a few months ago to ask for a consult. And so this guy has very, you know, this individual had a very interesting career. And again, like I said, I won't elaborate on this interesting career. But, you know, we were discussing things, and you know, I just kind of emphasized, you know, commercial space is basically the U.S. secret weapon. And he said, yeah, I get that now. I said, a few months ago, before I actually started talking to you, I really didn't realize the value of commercial space that I do now. And which, you know, basically, you know, tells me, okay, this person who has some pretty impressive credentials from his past finally understood, you know, the significance of commercial space. The Chinese and the Russians don't understand commercial space. One, the Russians hate the whole idea. They've hated it since the negotiations for the Outer Space Treaty. So they absolutely hate that. They hate the idea of commercial space. The Chinese really don't have commercial space because any private industry company is actually partially owned by the state. So you really don't have commercial space. They're trying to employ their own version of commercial space just so they can get the innovation out of it. However, they've got a problem too because their rocket industry is basically managed by the PLA and run by a bunch of big government corporations. They're prime contractors, and they're not going, you know, and as you know, politics and bureaucracy goes, you're not going to want to let go of that power too easily. So and we kind of have a similar situation here, you know. But well, look, SLS versus say Starship, you know, which one's going to get us to the moon and beyond. The commercial space, I just can't emphasize how important, how critical it is. And she's right. You know, she was actually absolutely right. You know, we're undervaluing the strategic, and I'm going to use strategic. I don't use that as just, you know, to throw a word in there. I use this as a actual important descriptor. The absolute strategic value of non-governmental, commercial, private, whatever you want to call it, space, and getting private actors involved because they make things happen a lot faster than, you know, the status quo. And, well, we've seen it. And I think, you know, SpaceX is probably a prime example, but there's also a lot of others out there who are demonstrating it as well.
Michael, we're at the 45-minute point. So when I joined this with the last night's show, you've done a full 90-minute show. Have we covered everything? Is there more that you would like to add on? Do you have we missed something? Have we overlooked something that we should know about?
No, and I think the main impetus was come and talk about, you know, this idea of a new regulatory framework, and I really wanted to emphasize the significance of that Supreme Court case, just because, like I said, I think it is going not only affect, you know, what happened with the EPA, but it's going to affect all executive agencies, including the executive agencies that are responsible for licensing private space activities. So, I mean, it really is. I mean, I appreciate more being an attorney, but I want to emphasize that to you, those of you who aren't attorneys or what have you, or don't, you know, work in this area, that, you know, that decision is going to be significant for many decades to come.
Tony sent in an additional part to his email, so he yep. got an 11th-hour email in. He says, sorry, I can't call. While SpaceX still shows Falcon 9 launches live, for at least the last couple of months, the broadcast and after the first stage landing, the deployment of Starlink is no longer shown. China and Russia have made statements that it should be a military target. The Air Force is funding some use of it and is testing F-35 communications. Also, ITD use for navigation rivals and is more robust to attack than GPS.
Yeah, I mean, it's... you know, after its utility in Ukraine is demonstrated, I mean, basically, it's going to become a military target. And I think, German, the last time I was here, we talked about Starlink and potential and how the Chinese were basically looking to bring it down. There was an article a few months back about that, and I actually consulted on that as well. Yeah, it's going to be a legitimate military target, as is any commercial spacecraft that's performing some sort of national security function will be. The rules are good. I mean, you know how I feel about the rules and stuff. I think it's going to go out the window, and it's going to be a big mess.
So I take it from Tony, they show the launch, but they don't show Starlink deployment anymore. I think that's what he's trying to say. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't see anything nefarious in that. I mean, with national security launches, you know, you'll see the fairing go by past the Centaur stage, but they will not show you the actual satellite itself nor the deployment. But that, of course, that's because it's classified. It's a national security thing, and the customer is always right.
And we're not the customer, so.
Well, the customer is either the DOD or the intelligence community, and they don't want you to see what kind of toys they're playing with. They get to play well with cool toys, and they said they don't want to share.
Yeah, not in my play box, right? So
I'm sure they have a lot of cool toys that would really be interesting to look at, but it's on need-to-know basis, and I guess we don't need to know. And that's okay.
Michael, I want to thank you very much for coming back on Monday to complete our program after yesterday, and really appreciate it. I'll get this archived by before noon tomorrow. I have an early morning physical therapy appointment, so that will take me up to noon to getting it archived, and I'll send it to you as usual when I get it. And again, I can't thank you enough for returning and for doing this and doing it promptly while it was all still fresh on our minds. And until the next time, when's the next time we should come knocking on your door? What are you looking at where it's time to start talking again?
December.
Okay, well, I've got my December dates all set up. I should send you the list so you can have...
We kind of do the end of the year thing anyway. So.
Yeah,
and actually, it'll be even more interesting because it'll be after the midterms.
Yes, it will, and they'll probably still be fighting about the winners, but I guess that's going to be par for the course now.
Well, it'll be interesting because the results will give you a better idea what direction the regulation we've been talking about might, you know, the direction it might take.
You know, I heard some people this has nothing to do with space, but I heard a new show, and they interviewed people from the French Election Service, whatever it's called. They spoke perfect English. And they explain their election service, and they get results almost immediately. They don't have any of these disputes, and they don't have any mail-order ballots, and they show voter ID, and everything is a manual ballot. They don't use computers, and some of their polls are very heavily populated. And I'm just wondering, God, how can they have such a smooth election and all we do is squabble and quibble and, you know, everything's broken, the machine's broken, the this is broken, the that is broken. I can carry your ballots and vote them any way I want. France doesn't do any of that, and their elections seem to work really well.
But individual states get to basically make their own election laws.
Here they do, yeah.
So that, you know, in Europe, you know, they're national. And you know, the French Republic is definitely a lot, you know, smaller in population size and demographics than, say, the U.S. is.
Still, reminds me when I used to go with my parents to the voting precinct in Tulsa, and it was a paper ballot with a stamp pad that you put an X in a circle with the stamp pad. And then you put the paper ballot in a locked ballot box. I don't remember disputes from back then, but maybe I'm just too young to remember. I was just too young to remember a,
I wish I were too young now. So that's another story. Michael, thank you very much, and I'll send you some dates, and we'll look forward to talking to you toward the end of the year.
Okay, very good.
Take care, listeners. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you have a good week. And Rand Stenberg is our guest for tomorrow night, so hopefully you can join us for our normal Tuesday program. And this program will be combined with the one from Sunday for a full Space Shuttle program, and it will be archived by tomorrow. Everybody have a great night and a great week coming up. As always, keep looking up. Goodbye from Michael, David, and the Space Shuttle.